Hello everybody, welcome back to the show. I am here with Steve and Sophia, the co-founders of Kaleido. The dynamic duo, they have been focused since the very beginning on making blockchain easier for everybody. Sounds like a noble mission, and they have succeeded significantly in that time. Over the course of this show, we're going to cover what have they been up to, what are they doing now, what have they seen in terms of challenges over the last sort of 12, 24 months in Web3, and what's coming next. Steve, Sophia, welcome to the show. How are you guys doing today?
Doing great. Really excited for the conversation. Can't wait to get into it.
Yeah, it's great to reconnect, Anthony. I know we've connected. You've been in many roles in the industry over the years, always been a real thought leader in all those roles. So it's great reconnecting here on your podcast. Congrats on all the success of the podcast.
I appreciate that. And I know you guys are road warriors. You are constantly out there, constantly talking to people, constantly at events. I don't know very many people. Maybe Vitalik is the only one who covers more miles than you guys. And so I appreciate that you managed to pause for an hour to take time with us. That's very kind of you. Where are you at the moment? Are you allowed to disclose your current location?
We're actually home-based here. That's Stephen Heyer in one of our conference rooms, which is why we have our backgrounds. We're actually in front of a very large bookcase together. So.
It's a tree being in the same way.
There we go. Actually physically in the same space. For those who are watching with us live, the backdrop may confuse you because it looks similar, but it's not quite similar. It was messing me up a little bit. There's the meme. There's the meme that people are going to use now. That's going to get used again, I'm sure. So guys, let's get started. Kaleido Origins. Tell us where it all started. I reckon it was, depending on who you believe, it was 2016, 2017, or 2018 where Kaleido actually began. Tell us a little bit about, for those who don't know, the origin story. Why did you guys start this business in the first place?
Yeah, actually, we started a little bit before that, just in terms of our personal histories. So going back to 2015, we're actually in a place you spent some time in the Web3 space was at IBM. I actually had a very large multi-billion dollar P&L on the enterprise systems business, which includes mainframes. If some of you remember, mainframes run a lot of things in the world, like ATM machines and airline tickets and hotel reservations and things like that. And really saw the blockchain emerging and thought this is something that's going to go all the way down to the system of record and legacy systems. We need to think about really moving our clients to the new ways of working, and had a big interest in sort of disrupting ourselves with launching something in the blockchain space. And that's how I ended up meeting Steve, who was on the cloud team. They were also doing a lot of research and investigations, and we basically joined forces and launched a new blockchain business unit, which had various components. We were responsible for the platform business and launched that. We had blockchain as a service, which is a technology platform, and had the team that was driving the open source work, which was donated to the Linux Foundation, became Hyperledger, and that was the first code base, Hyperledger Fabric. But I saw in those early 2 years all the struggles that companies were facing. If you get just a blockchain node as a service in a private network, that's that enterprise approach they were taking at the time. All the different layers you need to build on top of that, like 95% of the work needed to be done with sort of custom build outs, which very expensive, took years. So just, looking in your crystal ball, you could see that wasn't how people were going to get to business value. But that's, I guess, my view of a slice of the story. I don't know, Steve, if you want to add some more thoughts on that time period and the origin of Kaleido coming out of that.
And I think coming out of that, then Sophia and I's vision was, wow, Web3 is going to be so much bigger, right? It's going to impact so many different ways that consumers, do things online, the way that businesses transact with, with their consumers and how they share data with each other. And so in 2017, you're right in the middle there, Anthony, of your guesses, we started Kaleido. And, you know, the, our day one mission was really to help companies come online in Web3. And that continues to be the mission. And to your point, and the title of this podcast, everyone says it's not the technology, it's this or that. But actually, the technology can be pretty tricky, right, to get your arms around. And so we wanted to just build a big, easy button. We're very unopinionated about any one approach to blockchain or DLT, any one community or ecosystem. We think that we're in a multi-chain world, right? And that companies are going to need solutions that, you know, connect with wherever their consumers are. And, you know, so interoperability and key pieces of the infrastructure really just need to work. And, you know, we need a big easy button on top of that. So that was the day one sort of mission and vision around founding Kaleido. And in a lot of ways, it's still, you know, fast forward to 2023, it's still day one. It's still early days in this space. It's so much fun to get up every morning and to work with customers that have really big visions about how, you know, they want to transform what they're doing and how they want to connect and create new meaningful experiences.
Brilliant origin stories. Thank you so much for those, guys. What do you get when somebody in mainframes and someone in cloud comes together? You end up with Web3. I love that part of the story. Also, because you've kind of got the full spectrum of technology history around data kind of captured in collective learnings of what you guys were doing at the time. Also, a heavy appreciation for what it takes to integrate systems, what it takes to actually drive technology change. Something that my wife accused me of saying too much lately. She says when I'm on calls, all she ever hears me is using the words digital transformation. All we're really trying to do is to transform the way that we do stuff on the planet with technology. And Web3 gives you a whole new set of tools, whole new set of principles. But like you said, Sophia, it's hard. It's, you know, most enterprises will not start just coding on top of raw nodes. It's just they're not going to be programming raw smart contracts. It's just a little bit too complex to expect at this stage in the maturity, availability of developers, I guess, flux in the technology in and of itself, or the different flavors of blockchains, let's call it that maybe. I think the technology is still relatively stable, but the number of options you have, it's going to be difficult to expect non-Web3 native organizations just to jump in and say, no, we're going to get our hands on this. This is fine. This is how we work. When increasingly the appification of everything, the SaaSification of everything is taking the rest of the world in completely the other direction. And so you guys saw that coming well ahead of time. Still founded a blockchain business in IBM at the time. So congratulations for that, because without that, I probably wouldn't be here. So thank you to you guys. That was part of my journey. And yeah. Now look at you. Look where you are now, and you still say it's early. That's the interesting thing, right? You can be running a business for 6-7 years and still say, you know what, that's we're still early. You barely scratched the surface.
Yeah. Well, I was just gonna key off of what your wife was commenting on, the digital transformation. That was certainly a buzzword, I think, we had even before we started in our respective like joint ventures here in blockchain. And I think it's really with COVID now, post-COVID, you know, during when everyone all of a sudden had to just work from home, you couldn't be an insurance broker and have papers on the desk. You needed to just immediately pivot and figure out how could you work digitally. So I think that really advanced companies' digital transformation roadmaps by about a decade, even the most slow moving industries like insurance or healthcare as examples. And people are moving to the cloud as part of that. And you mentioned sort of the SaaSification of everything. And then really this once in a generation shift of systems. I mean, if you're replatforming a system, you're digitally transforming, moving to the cloud. People want to work together, for example, B2B as industry ecosystems. When it's B2C, they want to really engage with customers in a completely different way. And there's really a rich innovation toolkit that's emerging from Web3 that we see lots of light bulbs going off in our enterprise clients' minds. And they think, wow, I could use this to solve a problem we might have had for a decade or 20 years in our industry. And now the technology exists to solve that.
And to your point around the timeline, you know, it's still being early days while, you know, You've been in this space for a while, and so have we. Like, it's helpful to remind yourself to look across at other big waves of, you know, digital innovation. Look at IoT, look at AI, I think is a perfect example. I mean, if you look at those companies, it really does go back many years. Like AI is coming, so many categories of AI are coming of age right now. And, you know, realistically, web, you know, you can trace the roots of AI back, you know, many, many years, right? Before the beginnings of Web3. So I think it's realistic to say, you know, these are some really big foundational things that are happening in the core of the digital infrastructure of how the global economy works, right? There's the quick hit overnighters are great to keep everyone in the boat, to keep everyone excited, but the transformational sort of underpinnings, that to me is a big storyline that's really important, right? That's been sort of flying under the radar and just progressing month after month, year after year. And we're really on the cusp, I believe, of, you know, things. Let's take, you know, one example of something like asset tokenization, right? Which we all knew was a great use case, et cetera, et cetera. We've been reading about it, we've been experimenting. But now we're starting to see just a completely different, you know, mentality from our customers when you realize that so many things are going to be tokenized and tracked on a blockchain. And it's sort of like individual pieces of the puzzle. You get the big wow when you see the pieces of the puzzle coming together. And, you know, when a tokenized asset interacts with tokenized cash, right? Tokenized money, and that interacts with, you know, tokenized governmental rules. And once these things start really connecting and interoperating with each other, then you'll see, you know, just like AI, my belief is Web3 will all of a sudden, whoa, where did that come out of? Now all of a sudden everything's moving really quickly. Well, it's because there have been lots of people and companies just diligently working on this for a long period of time.
I hear you. It's probably like a comparison between if you've ever seen kind of narrow boats going down riverways and you kind of get to a lock and then you have to kind of pause at the lock and then go down and then go somewhere else and then look back up again. Compare that and just put a hyperloop in the middle and say, we've got a series of connections, processes, organizations that need to work together. But at the minute, their technology or their processes or their borders are not seamless. They don't work 24/7. They're not automated. But imagine what would happen if we could. And then imagine if everything was running on Hyperloop. And then, well, I guess we can all imagine the picture. You guys have drawn a real crowd today. We have got possibly the most geographically dispersed group of people in the comment section today. We've got shout out to Christopher in Lusaka, Zambia. We've also got Samson dialing in from Nigeria. We've got Chris, who says he's at 38,000 feet. I don't think I've ever heard anybody dialing into one of my shows from a plane before. He's clearly, he's, you know, Chris is out there bawling. He's on a private jet, listening in to Blockchain Won't Save the World. Shout to you, Chris. Salute to you for still making time.
A special sweatshirt or some sort of show swag hat.
That's it. If only I had merch. I'll look into that. Thank you. Moving swiftly on. So it's been a very, very big year for you guys, despite broader market conditions, despite the broader environment. You guys have been incredibly busy. Tell us what's been kind of your highlights or some of the important things you've been working on over the last 12 months.
Well, yeah, it's been something of just the story of Clido. It seems like when things are zigging, we're zagging sometimes. and anytime you have a company that's, you know, even bordering on crypto, then you have, you know, crypto has its own cycles, right? So there's sort of what's going on in the macro world, and we've all had an interesting experience over the last few years, wherever you are, with COVID, and then, you know, just all the economic stuff and the conflicts and so forth. And so the macro is where it is, to your point. Crypto also is where it is. But, you know, for the things that we focus on day in and day out, just sticking to that mission of helping companies transform, and you know focusing on the use cases that they really care about. There's sort of all of that churn and choppiness. We, in a way, we kind of have blinders on, and you know, the some of the things that are really top of mind, I'll speak in the general and then let Sophia add some more thoughts. But I mentioned one a minute ago, you know, asset tokenization, really, really hot all across financial services. I think I went for a period of months talking to many of the top banks around the world, you know, global top 10 exchanges, just, you know, systemically important players in financial services. And really often the only topic was around how tokenization is going to change their core business. And you know, really a change in mentality from the top of some of these institutions down, just from, okay, this is interesting, to this might happen, to this is happening, right? And we need to plot our strategy, right? And make corresponding investments to make sure that we're not left behind. Right.
And so, I was about to ask, are they seeing that as a threat or an opportunity at this point?
I think it's a mix of both. You know, threats, people move faster when they think it's a threat, right? And there's an extra level of impetus. So I think it is kind of still a two-sided coin. I do think that sort of the main Wall Street and sort of mainstream financial services are feeling, last year we're feeling threatened by DeFi. Let's say maybe they're feeling a bit less threatened by that. But now I actually think it's healthy. They're seeing the type of threats they're seeing are like, hey, actually it's not these outsiders, right, that are gonna come disrupt us. It's our core competitors, right? Everyone is going to be doing this. And so that's a different view on threats. And it's a different view on opportunities, right? And so the companies that are the most innovative, we're talking about the financial services space in this example, are the ones that are really leaning in. And I think probably in the next 12, 18 months, you'll start to see some early winners that start to emerge. And it'll be interesting to see how that plays out.
I think it's a good shout. And to be fair, you would be a little bit daft to be saying, oh, DeFi is not a threat anymore. Yes, the market cap, relatively speaking, might be lower, but the number of users has gone up. The number of smart contracts deployed has gone up. The number of active participants involved in it, the number of chains creating innovation, the amount of code that is available to be reused and redistributed is all growing. Maybe not exponentially, but certainly growing. And so just because the value looks relatively lower than it was doesn't mean that the scene is declining. In fact, if I was in front of somebody with that same hypothesis, I'd say, I think you're reading it wrong.
Yeah, I think you're looking at leading indicators. They're looking at lagging indicators. They say, oh, well, FTX and some of the other failures, they think, you know, the foot's off the gas pedal there. I do think you asked, you know, there's a lot of exciting. I see a caption this 2022 to 2023, a lot of exciting news and advancements. Just reflecting, it has been an exciting year. You know, we've always been very market-driven, looking at where our clients need, the technologies they're interested in. So a year ago, we announced partnering with Polygon, which was interesting to see. Matic went up 30% on the day of the announcement, but now that they were getting into enterprise space and partnered with us, so it's like, okay.
Moving markets, guys, moving markets every day.
Yeah, but we've, so really this new exciting space, app chain space. So, you know, we started in the early days, it was very polemic, like private versus public, and it's almost a religious debate. And some people are still stuck in that, which is surprising because that feels like 2015, 2016. But really there's been, you know, public chains saying, well, we do need performance and scale, and in some cases, low gas or no gas, for, you know, that we need the interoperability between the ecosystems. We don't want like walled gardens. And then, you know, the private enterprises are thinking the same way. You know, there's a lot of use cases. We work with gaming companies and they're saying, we have a great, you know, native in-game experience, but we want to replace in-game assets with NFTs. A lot of those will be low gas, no gas, minted because it's millions a day, but some will be very valuable and people want to move those to other games in our portfolio. We have, you know, some of these gaming conglomerates have lots of games in their estate. Or, you know, just move it to like public marketplaces and monetize those assets. So you get those sorts of use cases, enterprises looking at like credentialing and awards or, you know, certifications in industry, and those need to, you know, they can be minted or distributed internally in a company with an eye to, you know, their people want to take that with them when they leave the company and they want to show that publicly. So you see some of these innovations coming that really are driving more of a hybrid approach, and app chains, you know, the rise of app chains has been quite interesting over the last year. We more recently also announced partnering with Avalanche, and we were in Spain at the Avalanche Summit. And we're talking to a lot of other communities. And one interesting way we interact with really quite a few ecosystems is through the Firefly Project. So we, you know, early on we said, we, you know, started Clido, companies are going to need a full stack of technology, and we're going to run the best of breed open source. We looked around, and we, and some of these components we started open sourcing from day one, but, you know, we were building up our product and our as a service stack. And we looked around, no one, there was no community, no open source community at that on and off chain layer that was so critical, really, it's like decentralized middleware for Web3. So over 2 years ago, we open sourced that. That's the Linux Foundation Hyperledger's fastest growing Web3 new community. And we have everyone from Swift to large healthcare companies, to insurance companies, to trade finance, to, you know, small and large companies across all geographies using that now. So I think it's really rewarding, especially to our, you know, we're all engineers here and technologists, to just really be driving the industry forward with an open approach. I think governments really appreciate that. I mean, people like to be able to see the code. And, you know, that's a great way we've been interacting. Even I know you're with IOHK now. You know, they've been talking to us over the last year or so as well about just ways to integrate and really open up more options and this sort of full stack to just build apps more quickly on top of any particular layer one. People like Blackchain in Latin America sort of built extensions based on this and just are opening up more of these facilities to everyone who's building on them. So that's been exciting. And it's been exciting to see, you know, Hyperledger's evolved quite a bit as well. I mean, they're now a foundation. They have all different types of projects. They have, you know, public chains. They have, you know, different varieties of tool sets. So really looking to be someone that enterprises could go to, because sometimes it's hard for companies, like, what is that one event? What is that one organization? Who can I talk to? Where can I learn about more use cases? And that ends up being very fragmented for the enterprise audience, because you have a lot of ecosystem-based events that are tied to a particular, like, layer one. Then, you know, you can have more crypto-focused ones, just more generally, and then maybe more industry-focused, but it's hard to get a bigger lay of the land of all the tools and sort of connections, learnings, best practices people are looking for.
Yeah, it's certainly fragmented, and like knowing who to trust in a trustless space is already weird. Shout out Linux Foundation, shout out Daniela, who's been doing incredible work there. And like you said, the interesting thing is the technology variations are sort of merging to some extent. It's clear that to some organizations or in some use cases, being on public networks that are decentralized, that have open governance, that have open source, matters in some cases. In other cases, we still haven't necessarily solved for regulatory compliance or data protection. In some cases, exactly what I'm working on at this particular point of time with IO and with the Midnight team is trying to solve for regulatory compliant, data protective public chains. And that's a space that the narrative is growing there as well. So we're going to see a whole barrage of that technology enter the market as well. But ultimately, it's no good to anybody if we can't bridge the gap between those people who are running businesses, who are operating organizations today, who need to integrate technology with them. And that's one of the things that I know Hyperledger Foundation and Linux do incredibly well is they focus on the grind, the gritty, you know, non-glamorous, not particularly exciting elements of standardization, of industry education, of trying to identify opportunities where the community can work on particularly intransigent problems, where that will open the floodgates for technology to come in if you can work on particular connectors or particular libraries. And that's also what you guys do to some extent, right? I mean, the point is that the first product that I ever remember seeing was the original Collider Wiki, Wiki Wizard. The original Wizard, which was basically three or four clicks and an Ethereum node. And I looked at that and I thought, that's really quite impressive. I was in Deloitte at the time. We were doing bits and bobs with everything. We were doing lots and lots of very manual work with Hyperledger Fabric in 2017, which was quite hard work. And then Ethereum and Collider, shit, that's going to change things for good and bad, right? And I was thinking from a competitive landscape, but for giving people access to public chains and being able to start experimentation and lowering the barrier to innovation, that's critical. And that's what you guys kind of do every day. So salute to you for doing it.
Well, I appreciate that. And you know, from that initial launch with, like, you know, a blockchain as a service where you can just get in Ethereum mode, we've just kept expanding. And what the market and what our customers have been telling us is, you know, that the easy button for the blockchain node is great, but the reality, kind of the dirty little secret, is that there was still this huge burden on a developer to handle all the edge cases, right? Of if something as simple as getting a transaction onto a blockchain where you're entirely sure that it is on the blockchain, right? And just like managing that round trip. Sounds simple on the surface, but there's a ton of complexity in it. And so that's where the big wow for us was. And Sophia mentioned this Firefly project. That's where it was born, because our customers were saying it's still too hard for developers. And so the idea of building a Web3 gateway that, like, by design is neutral, right? It's Switzerland in the mix. It's very neutral. It's even down to being controlled by, you know, the Linux Foundation, which itself is designed to be a neutral body. And then creating it super pluggable so that any community, it's agnostic to whether, you know, it's an EVM chain under the covers or it's a UTXO-based model. And any chain can come in and plug around it, you know, creating it to be this super pluggable kind of framework has kind of taken it to the next level, you know, so that, you know, even the Tezos of the world and the Cardanos of the world, all these communities are coming around saying, okay, let me plug in to make sure that, you know, this agnostic framework can connect, you know, and can provide a first-class experience. And that's open source code. So any developer can take that and run that themselves. You know, obviously Kaleido, part of our core business is then taking that open source engine where there's no vendor lock-in, but providing a first-class, you know, enterprise kind of experience for our customers. So there's 24/7 support around it. We've built some extensions. And I think the next frontier then is to help developers understand the patterns, right, that have emerged. And there's kind of the right way to tokenize something and the wrong way, right? Of like what data goes on chain, what data doesn't go on chain, you know,
Very many wrong ways.
we've exhausted all the wrong ways to finally find the right way, right? But baking in those patterns, right, and just giving developers APIs to go work with. And I think then you finally reached it. The frontier where it's like it's not that you have to go be, you know, this deep protocol expert in Solidity and EVMs and stuff. It's like, hey, I'm a developer. I know the audience that I'm building an app for, right? And almost like making a Web3 app as simple as building a mobile app or a web app, right? Because I just have the APIs and I know that the patterns of how to interact with the blockchain have just been made really simple for me. And I can go and pull Web3 into my app rather than having to like jump off the deep end into Web3 and try to get my bearings and take this long journey to doing.
Yeah, developer experience is massive. And we're now just about emerging, I think, into a world where SDKs, low code solutions, or even in some cases, no code solutions. This is a shameless plug, but Marlo on Cardano came out this week. I'm only saying it because it's in context. Otherwise, I wouldn't be out here shilling, I promise. But part of the solution stack for Marlo smart contracts is you have a no-code smart contract composer. You are able as a non-developer to take common components of what would be in a smart contract, what would be the activities, what would be the kind of if then kind of components, and say, right, I will create something that will create a smart contract. That doesn't have the full stack associated with it, right? So you still need the rest of the Kaleido part. And you know, I would love to see Cardano in Kaleido. I would love to see Algorand in Cardano. I'd love to see all the chains, Polkadot in Cardano, right? Because when we see that, we're then giving people a meaningful choice of, you know, we have an easy stack to build. You have your choice of how you manage tokens or what type of tokens and block space you want and you need. And you can then figure out the rest. In the same way as we're making it easier to manage cloud storage, in the same way we're making it easier to manage analytics, in the same way we're easy to create front ends for AI these days, this is still infrastructure. And the easier we can make it, the better. So shameless plug from my side. We were going to talk about that. We started talking about learnings, and I'm interested just to do a little bit of a retrospective on the last 12 months, because I'm interested, as you've been having the conversations with banks, healthcare providers, automotives, at conferences, with the community, Web 2, Web 3, Web 2.5, novices and experts, it's impossible not to have noticed some of the above the line impact of some bankruptcies, some nefarious actions from financial services institutions that just happen to be Web3 focused. There were, you know, no significant issues around blockchains. Mm-hmm. A couple of hacks here and there, a couple of bridges that weren't as secure as we would have liked them to be. But broadly, the big headlines were that financial institutions, exchanges like FTX, VCs like Three Arrows Capital, Luna, a stablecoin project that started with good intentions, but that had too much human interaction with the actual decision making of the algorithm, were seen to fail. And as a result, that was seen by most as a failure of Web3, which we all know is not the case. What have been some of your learnings from the last 12 months of that struggle? And what imperatives does that give us for the use of decentralized technology going forward from now? Does it change the vision? Does it change the mission at all? Or is it still more of the same?
Yeah, I think, you know, some of those examples like FTX is just outright fraud. So it's, as you said, it's nothing related to the technology. I guess I'm reflecting, maybe taking this in a little bit of a different perspective with the enterprise lens. When FTX failed, you saw some of these very large, expensive projects come out of the woodworks and finally pull the plug, even though people knew they were on life support for years, because they thought, my project's just a small rounding error compared to how big the FTX fiasco is. That's my theory. So, you know, you saw Australian Stock Exchange, Fold Shop, and they're probably the largest. There were a number of others who were sort of like a Gen 1 approach that if you, you know, you look publicly, a lot of these raised up to $50 million, whether it's, you know, back, somebody already Fold Shop before, like B3i, which is Corda-based. There were some, you know, fabric-based ones, and there was a mix of these early Gen 1 projects that, you know, just pulled the plug. And if you start with the Australian Stock Exchange, you know, it's interesting. It ended up being a $250 million write-off, about 7 years of trying to get DAML digital assets, you know, to work on-prem, and really getting back to what we said earlier, and maybe I think Petter is getting into in the comments. You know, people just viewed like blockchain, they thought blockchain's going to solve everything, I think, which is your podcast has a riff on that. But it's really just 5 to 10%. It's a beating heart of what the differentiation, but you still have this huge, you know, 95% still that you need to build out. And if it's a 6-7 year project with just throwing hundreds of bodies over the years, and they're all building like custom code, and you know, how are you going to get to the scalability performance? Is it the right architecture? So the other point, you know, that's been made is people in Gen 1 thought everything needs to be on chain. And the architecture didn't even contemplate all the other layers that you need. So there are these best practices that have emerged. And what we've seen in the last year, you know, you look at someone like Swift, and they have a point of view, which is, you know, today we help with messaging, we're a nonprofit, collaborative of the banks, cooperative of the banks. You know, if people start working on CBDCs at the ecosystem level, you know, you're going to get digital islands. So maybe there's an exploration here with our member banks and central banks. Is there a way to create a connector between these islands, a CBDC connector, a gateway? And they came to us, you know, and, you know, in the spring and said, how long would this take to stand up a fully compliant CBDC regulated infrastructure that we could onboard a central bank to? You know, for us, that's, you know, a couple of weeks. Like this
you
would
said
have
four,
been
four clicks, right? Or
this would have been, this is all the way up to that, even providing user experience for the central banks. So you know, in Gen 1, this would have been a 3 to 5 year project, $30 to $50 million. That's a standard price tag. I actually spoke to someone at a conference recently who was presenting. They were a telco, and they said, we have all these partners. We have this really interesting solution we built. When I said the 30 to 50 million time frame, they were like, yeah, we spent that much. Exactly. You nailed it. So, and of course, some of these are just in the news, and it's like public what their funding was, because the stakeholders had been public about what, you know, all the members of the consortium, what they had put in. So you can really see the Gen 1 approach, Gen 2 approach. I mean, in terms of SWIFT, there were 18 central banks and global transaction banks who participated. So, you know, you had people from Banco de France, to Singapore MAS. They actually had a lot more as observers too, 200 participants from those institutions, HSBC, and, you know, a lot of the larger commercial banks. And, you know, they're sharing these learnings. So they have a white paper, anyone can read it. We could share that afterwards. But, you know, now we're in a situation where, you know, they spent the months on actually thousands of transactions involving hundreds of people. And like, what should wholesale, you know, scenarios look like? What should retail? What is CVP? What is PVP? You know, really getting to the business value. And that's what I think Steve and you were talking about earlier. Like, it's the early days and people are moving past just getting enamored with this tech is so cool to, like, we really need to get the ROI and the business results. And that's something that, you know, the Gen 1 approach really didn't focus on enough. And obviously something's going to collapse under its own weight if they're not able to show, like, financial benefit to the people who are, you know, in some cases spending years in these initiatives. And, you know, it's really swung to, wow, it's just a matter of weeks and you can do truly enterprise-grade, performance, scalable, compliant projects, and you don't even need to worry about the tech. We actually were hosting bi-weekly meetings with all the banks and office hours, thinking they'll be asking about the tech. And really, it was the conversation was not about the tech. It was about what can you do with CBDCs and really the core premise of what the project was about. And then we're also working with the other side of it, where we're running ecosystems. And again, it's like a central bank with all of the commercial players. And some of them have opened it up to over 100 submissions, and they're running 15 live projects. And you get all from like the small startup with a really cool idea to like the largest credit card company in the world. And you can allow for that spectrum of innovation. And I think we need to do that to really figure out how to move together to solve some of these interesting challenges and opportunities.
Fascinating insight. And thank you so much for sharing that. And I mean, most people may not have heard exactly about that. We'll try and put the paper in the show notes and make sure that people can get access to it. But I think the dichotomy of approach there is clear. You can go and do what feels, for those of you who've worked in digital transformation, there's that word again, or who've seen or heard or even just read in the papers about any kind of core banking transformation, right? When you change the core system underneath a bank, it takes years, you know, 2, 3, 4 years. All of the connecting points to databases, all of the applications that sit on top, all of the infrastructure you want to host, whether you want to put it on-prem, whether you want to put it in cloud, whether you want to have redundancy, all of these different components take time, they take effort. There's so many moving parts. The bank is operating at the same time. The stock exchange is another example of that, albeit you're then adding new technology, you're then adding custom code, you're then adding the requirement to volume test a language that may not have been used at that particular, or a framework that's been used at that particular scale. ASX was the poster child for DLT and financial services for a long time. And I don't want to see it as an expensive failure, because I think that we should be celebrating every failure in every industry and every use of technology, providing people don't get hurt and that there's no downturn effects of those learnings. But right, what we've learned from this is that that particular model of transformation is expensive. That particular model of transformation is complex, is difficult to scale operationally, organizationally, not just how many transactions can I do, but how do I get people to build on top of what I'm building? How do I get the ability to stand up the infrastructure easily across borders? Well, if it's already there and it's already cross-border, well, that's a good start. And then we continue, right? So that particular example, I don't know if you noticed the launch of Canton, the latest DLT connector program. I'm going to have Yuval from Digital Asset on the show in a couple of weeks' time. So Canton will have its day in court. And, you know, I'm really interested to hear more about how does this become more like public chain now? And there were some commitments around that being open networks, about there being nodes, sort of. It'll be an interesting exploration. And I definitely want to talk about what did we learn from ASX in the process of that, because like I said, if we're not learning from how do we construct these very sophisticated, very significant, very high value, and in some cases high volume systems, if we can't learn from those things, we're not going to benefit everybody else. So I really, really want to surface that too.
I did enjoy reading your LinkedIn post on Canton.
I tried to be as objective as I could. And I genuinely want to learn, right? You can only learn so much from reading a white paper. They actually released two white papers, which was novel. But the ones that I did read, I kind of got a sense for it. But even early days, right? I think the project is still spinning up. The vision, the reasons why are actually very, very similar to what we're working on at Midnight, which is a public chain on Cardano that's focused on data protection. Mm-hmm. The issues they have is that transactions are broadcast to everybody. And that transactions on blockchains have to compete for transaction space. And to some extent, you also have the kind of double free market of gas. So, throughput prices and fees also change. But there are many ways you can address that, even with public chains.
And as an industry, we really should experiment with different models for chains and the pros and cons of that. And so I think it's great to see that, you know, new chains coming online. It'll be interesting, you know, to dig into, you know, how the approach to privacy, you know, and the pros and cons to that versus how maybe, you know, the Cardanos of the world and the Polygons and how they're thinking about privacy, and to let that all play out, right, in the larger ecosystem. I think it's so fundamentally important. I mean, when you think about it at the end of the day, just what we talked about over the last 30 minutes from, you know, central banks and the M0 of the money supply to, you know, the M1 of the money supply and just banks and tokenizing deposits, all the way through to, you know, various, we're talking about exchanges and, you know, just assets and various things being tokenized. The scale of what we're talking about is just tremendous, right? And so I think it's great. I think it's appropriate to see, you know, different approaches, different communities really, first of all, focusing on more and more on privacy and scalability, which I think is great, and less and less on, you know, some of the things that were around in crypto the last cycle, right, where people are taking the downside of where we're currently in the broader crypto market and really building. I know it's like an overused, kind of metaphor, but it is just really encouraging looking across the breadth of the projects, even within Kaleido, the sort of things that come across our desks on a day-to-day basis. And we've just never been more excited for the Web3 space as a whole. And these things, they just happen slowly, but all of a sudden you wake up one day and you see multiple things happening together. So definitely take the learnings out of the Gen 1, as we were calling it, but, you know, rolling that forward, right, into what's happening right now, because stock exchanges aren't going to stop, right, even coming out of that particular project that was mentioned. And in fairness, we could have mentioned many other ones that just happened to come up, right? But stock exchanges aren't going to stop, right, because, you know, the value of tokenizing things and a ways that you can trust and transparently track, like the value is so self-evident that the momentum of the ecosystem is just pulling everything forward.
Yeah, $16 trillion worth of assets that could be tokenized or that could benefit from being tokenized according to BCG, which is not an insignificant addressable market to be going after, to be fair. So from that perspective, again, you know, any innovation needs to have commercial viability as well as technical feasibility and desirability to the user. So if you've got that sort of value case, and I use it fairly often just to remind people that's out there, those are assets that we quantify right now. I think that's important. I wanted to ask a quick sidebar question, because as I sit, you know, reading, watching, learning about Web3, we have also in the last 12 months seen a number of new chains, new variations on chains. We now have layer three as a concept, right? That wasn't there before. So there are projects out there calling themselves layer threes. We've seen Optimism, Arbitrum, Sui, Aptos. We've seen increasing growth of Polkadot and Cosmos, sidechains on Cardano now, and there will be other things. When you guys are looking at the, you know, what's going to fit in the app store, right? You know, you guys are the candy shop of easy blockchain. How do you look at these projects? Do you think, oh, great, there's another one, let's go grab them? Or do you think, oh, God, we've already got enough to do. That's really complicated. Why can't you just kind of slow down, please?
We are pretty market driven, as I mentioned earlier, and we're listening to what the client, our clients, enterprise clients, like real projects, accomplishing real things with real budgets and buy-in are looking to use. So there's, I guess the success of those ecosystems would have to be reflected in, you know, people wanting to use that tech. One comment I sort of jumped in, I wanted to make, I'm just reflecting on the learnings topic, and I think it's applicable here. There's people who've been in the space for a while, and they're seeing new technology, new communities. But I think one of the questions is pretty interesting, asking about, hey, everyone just thinks like blockchain is the whole solution, and how do we help those people? And for me, that feels like a very like early question, like for maybe the early years versus where we are now. And I think what's happening is, I don't know how familiar you are with some theories around technology adoption and Geoffrey Moore and this classic book, Crossing the Chasm. But you have, you know, new technology, and people say, well, like you can get 10-15% of like early adopters to just try anything. But the challenge is to cross the chasm and get into that early majority. And it's really like the bell curve. Then there's late majority, and then there's laggards, and laggards are like still using VHSs or whatever is like the old tech at this point. So I feel just from our vantage point, we have you know, a couple of ways we go to market. And one is, you know, we have this digital self-service platform where people can just build things on a free tier. So we get to see a lot of people coming through our front door across all industries and geos. And it's interesting just seeing this early majority starting to come online. And I think it's almost our responsibility, and you're doing a great job of this, Anthony, with your blog post and the podcast. You know, the lessons learned so people don't repeat the same sort of, you know, going down the wrong paths when we already have the best practices. We have architectures and approaches so that people can get to business value faster and not fall into those traps. So we see sort of a bifurcated audience, because there's a very mature audiences that you're talking about, and they're looking at new tech, and you know, they can be very sophisticated and many years into exploring the use cases and projects that are live. And then we have a whole new generation coming online. And as you know, we've been talking, it's early days, but we do see that. I do feel like this early majority is starting to come online, and then we're sort of repeating the same basic questions, the same basic education is needed. But hopefully we can infuse that with a lot of insight and learnings from, you know, the first 8 years of enterprise blockchain.
Yeah, eight years to figure out the, I don't want to call it the basics of infrastructure, but the kind of the critical learnings of how to use decentralized or distributed infrastructure. It feels like we could have got there, but in the middle, there was a lot of trial and error. There was a lot of expensive acquisitions, a lot of expensive investments. Like you said, project that didn't go under. We could have continued down the list. Some notable IBM projects or IBM initiated projects that didn't succeed.
Yeah.
Some blockchains that didn't succeed in totality, or some that have gone to a very low current level of activity because either funding was withdrawn or because the developer experience or the developer base lost faith in the project. And, you know, timely segue into a question that I wanted to ask is that not all of the people that kind of beat down your door are CEOs or kind of the heads of banks. Developer experience is something that most people probably in LinkedIn at least don't get to hear or see as much of compared to if you were in GitHub or if you were in Stack Overflow, for example. Mm-hmm. Could you give us the short version of the importance of developer experience and how you guys are looking at it? Again, that's kind of links also to Peter's question of how are we not just showcasing the shiny blockchain thing that we can now enable with a few clicks? How do we talk about actually enabling developers or people who build applications and systems to do that better?
We think a lot about, as Clido, you know, using AWS, for example, as a reference. If you think about the way that AWS itself is built, it's while it's certainly there's a lot of their core customers are just the largest companies in the world. It is a developer-centric experience and platform with a catalog of services. And when you build something like that, you can open up the front door and let in everyone. So a lot of the power and the awe of when these, you know, initial cloud-based platforms came along was like, wow, an individual developer can get fundamentally the same experience that a large company can get, right? And I think from a developer experience perspective, you know, when we started Kaleido, kind of fundamentally understanding that in our backgrounds, that was a day one goal, right? To serve large companies and our mission of bringing them online, but to provide that same experience, to build something, you know, mass scale under the covers, so that even individual developers can come. There's still today a completely free tier. You can sign up, you can spin up some nodes. You know, there's obviously limits around how all that works, but you know, you can start completely free as an individual developer. There's the same catalog of APIs to start building with. And then sort of like that experience where you can swipe a credit card at the right moment in time and move up tiers.
So this is encouraging the tinkering stage, right? This is the, you know, it could be an individual. It could even be somebody who's kind of testing out enterprise software. They're saying, right, how does this look? How does this feel? What does it do? For those who are less familiar with APIs in Web3, could you just give us a couple of examples of, you know, what would the APIs be that guys are using here and what do they do?
Yeah, well, if you think about the Web3 stack, you know, you obviously need things like wallets. You need to submit transactions. You may be using ancillary things like IPFS for storage or a chain link for an Oracle for, you know, more sophisticated patterns. You're probably doing something with tokens of one form or other, right? So, you know, having all of those just as a big catalog of APIs that you can play and just sort of like Legos snap into the application that you're building, it makes it a whole lot easier for a developer to have that all in one place. And you can even experiment with different chains right at the bottom. What we tried to do with the architecture is layer it, because all tech stacks at the end of the day are layered, and that provides loose coupling from one layer to the next. So that gives developers a lot of mobility through those experimentation phases to be really fluid with the sort of things that they're testing with. And that accelerates really at the end of the day, the space as a whole, right? Because those projects can move faster. The ones that aren't going to make it, you can learn that easy, you know, faster, cheaper, easier, and earlier on. And the ones that are going to make it now have a seamless path. You know, just like going back to the AWS example, you know, once you've started on those APIs and with, you know, with those various tools, wallets, you know, nodes, being able to roll that forward and say, oh, wait, it's already a production ready type infrastructure. I don't need to stop, you know, once I'm excited and I have success with my project and stop for a year and a half and go figure out how to do it in a real production ready way. I can just, you know, click a few more buttons and now I'm ready to go.
Nice. And so I mean, imagine swapping in and out. I want to move from Ethereum to Polygon because I want lower fees or I want a higher throughput. I want to switch the where I get my data from, or I want to switch where I put my data afterwards. You know, I want to be able to use decentralized storage, or I need to use on-premise or whatever else it might be. I want to change parts of how the application talks to the data and then the chain. I want to change some of the smart contracts that I'm using. So where the automation of business logic happens or how it happens or what it does. These are Legos that people who understand building applications that sit on decentralized infrastructure, they can have more flexibility. That can become an easier thing to do rather than trying to copy and paste code into a compiler from GitHub or Stack Overflow or somewhere and try and kind of do it all themselves. It's click a few buttons, here we go. If I have appropriately represented Kaleido in one sentence.
Perfect. You're now dead.
Not all of it. Final question, and Sophia, I'm always interested in thinking about this one, because full decentralization is a vision that many people have. It's a slightly maximalist view to some extent, saying that everything must be decentralized all of the time, everywhere, must be sensor resistant, must be unstoppable, must be governed, must be open source, must be everywhere. And I've seen a number of projects or attempts at trying to create fully decentralized websites, fully decentralized kind of e-commerce and so on and so forth, where literally every part of the stack is decentralized, that is open, is, you know, hosted across multiple nodes and a network at every layer of the stack. Are we close?
So I'll start and you can jump in. I want to go back to, you know, if you think about the major themes of the next couple of years, you know, really coming along quickly are things like DIDs, right? So those, that's such a, identity, such a foundational component. Things like privacy. So I'm really bullish on ZK and a lot of the work that's going on there. So what you're seeing are key pieces, key ingredients, coming of age, right? Before our very eyes. When you talk about something as fundamental as decentralization, another key thing that's happening is sort of the chains themselves organizing into hierarchies and layers, right? So from layer zeros, layer ones, layer twos, and you mentioned layer threes, which we didn't even get into in this hour or so action packed. Layer threes are a really big deal, right? We're very bullish on those, and that's an area where app chains and that category of stuff we think is a really important piece. But what you are seeing are really key pieces of the puzzle starting to come together and people starting to get that. I think we're still a ways away from full decentralization, but I'm sitting here in 2023 feeling like we're a heck of a lot closer than if we had done this podcast 12 months ago, I'd have been like, you know, farther off. But just like we talked with AI, you know, that innovation stream is not, it fits and starts, right? And so I feel like even though people may feel like the industry is down right now, I feel like we're moving in a fast innovation timeframe. And it's really exciting to see DIDs, to see, you know, layer threes and all these other pieces moving faster and coming together. You know, I think we still have a ways to go, right? But and regulation is another key piece of the puzzle. That's speeding up, right? That is speeding up now. And so getting more clarity is going to help a lot of people moving forward. So that's my thought is we're closer than we have ever been, but there are still more things that we need to achieve to get there.
Yeah, I think there's a maturation in the approach. In the early days, there were certainly, you know, people who were crypto anarchists and, you know, they felt like the entire existing financial system is going to be disrupted and everything's going to go away. And we're just going to like magically leap to this new utopia, which is like full decentralization. And the reality is we need to meet people where they are. I mean, we need to go to the store and find food there and, you know, get paychecks and, you know, see a doctor and go to an ATM machine or use plane airplanes, like we mentioned earlier. You know, so those, you know, there has to be a transitional sort of approach, which starts with where we are and you're layering on these new technologies and components. And then it's not just a technology question. There's really fundamentally, like, in this new world of full decentralization, like, what does a company look like? You know, what does a group of people working towards a common goal? So if you're in a company, you know, like LinkedIn, it's like fully, what does full decentralization look like there? And how can tokenization enable that or ownership? And then just identity, you know, like our whole way of working as a society is kind of going to evolve. So these are really deep questions and, you know, that are a lot of other voices, I think, could weigh in on this and academics across many disciplines. So it's pretty fascinating.
100%. The is it better decentralized is a really big question. That's probably our part two show in reality, because anyone who's tried to work in a fully remote team will already start feeling immediately some of the inefficiencies or some of the changes. Then imagine that your team is fully anonymous. Then imagine that everyone is paid in crypto. Then imagine that you have to make fundamental decisions every day based on governance and voting rather than hierarchy. And suddenly you start feeling some of the questions of that might be a little bit hard, or that might be a lot harder than what I have to deal with so far when we have a little bit of kind of rank and file and I know who my boss is and we have forecasts and we have financial projections. Not saying we can't have that in a decentralized world either. But guys, it has been an absolutely fascinating discussion. We've covered a lot more than I thought we would. We've been all around the houses. We've gone all the way back to 2015. We've come all the way forward to full decentralization. Thank you so much for making time. We got some of the questions in. For those questions we didn't answer, we'll try and pick some of those up in the show notes or in the comment section. Peter, I see you with your question, and there were many others as well. So thank you guys for weighing in on LinkedIn Live with the questions in the Q&A. Safe travels wherever is next for you. As I said, you guys are full road warriors. I know you're out there busy meeting people, meeting clients, meeting the industry, and trying to make things happen. Excited to see Layer 3 starting to appear on Kaleido. Excited to see Zero Knowledge starting to appear on Kaleido soon. I'm very happy to help with any of that as you guys get on with it. And stay safe out there.
Thanks so much, Anthony. Really enjoyed it. Thanks for having us.
Thanks.
Thanks, guys. See you soon. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks again for listening to the Blockchain Won't Save the World podcast. As always, opinions in this episode are mine and those of my guests alone. If you want to find out more, please feel free to connect with me on LinkedIn. Check out some of the other episodes on the Blockchain Won't Save the World podcast, and check out the YouTube channel, also called Blockchain Won't Save the World. Stay safe out there.